This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The PGA Tour is all systems go, and so is the new show, Early Wedge, on the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Sportsline experts Sia Nejad, Mike McClure, and Eric Cohen, alongside myself, Rick Gaiman, Patrick McDonald, and Jason Sobel. 5 times per week, the Early Wedge provides the best information for DFS lineups, outright selections, and so much more. Follow and listen to Early Wedge in the Early Edge feed on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, that's exactly what they want to do. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to a Tuesday edition of the program where the studio once again is a little lonely because Fred is, I think he's about to head back from Japan tomorrow or sometime tonight because of the time change. I think we figured out it was like a 14-hour difference, so he may be waking up tomorrow in Japan to a flight home. Sue is off for a couple of days. She will be back on Thursday. Everyone is back except for Ethan, who's filling in. Ethan will be out on Thursday because somehow he finagled the day off to go to opening day. Congratulations on that. Did I get everything right? I'm trying to chart the course of the show here this week. And then you're back on Friday, but I think you're going to be here in the studio. I was just talking to Tricia. We had some difficulties with some of the staffing for the fish. Have you heard about this?
I have.
Yeah, okay.
I think that I'm actually going to be out there.
You might be because we need you out there, right?
Yes, so I think I'm going to be out there for my second straight fish fry.
Well, that'll be good. Queen of All Saints this week on Christopher in South County, St. Mary Magdalene next week, and then Ott's Tavern in Millstatt on the 11th of April, as we are right in the middle, smack dab in the middle of these here this afternoon. It's a beautiful day. It's a little chilly. Nice spring day in St. Louis. We have a lot to cover. Brad Young is going to join us here for one of the opening segments in a few minutes. He's our chief legal analyst, a partner with Harris Dow, Fisher & Young. There's a bunch of different cases that we'll talk about, including New York City allowing citizens to vote. That issue, thankfully, has gone away. 23andMe has entered bankruptcy. There's actually, I just sent this to Brad, because there's an interesting case, and in my sense, there's maybe quite a bit to this, because in the era of name, image, and likeness with athletes in sports, I think most people are aware at this point, we really don't have college athletes. You have semi-pro or professional athletes that are paid. All these players that we saw for Mizzou, they're being compensated. Everyone's got a different deal because of sponsorships, etc. But what happened to Brady Cook, for example, or other kids? I don't think even Brady Cook is the one that I'm thinking about here, but maybe. But Brady Cook and some of the earlier stars that weren't paid. Drew Locke is who I'm thinking about. Thank you. Brady Cook actually did get NIL. But I don't know if you saw this, Ethan, because now you have Drew Locke, Sophie Cunningham, who's a big star in the Mizzou basketball team. They're joining an antitrust lawsuit against the NCAA because their position is, wait a second, right before all this stuff kicked in with NIL, we helped make the University of Missouri, and other athletes could make the case for other universities, a whole lot of money, but we weren't compensated at all. So, hey, what about us? So then the question becomes, well, how far back can you actually go and request that money? Can we go back to the early 2000s? Can we go back to the 1990s? We're going to ask Brad these questions here coming up.
That's where that question gets extremely difficult because, like you said, this could just keep going on and on. I mean, For the students that didn't make money, all of them, you would think, are probably going to say, hey, I'm justified. If they're making money, then I'm justified to make some, especially the ones that didn't make it pro, which, let's be honest, is the large majority of them.
We'll find out. There's always very specifics when it comes to lawsuits and the aspects of this that relate to the courts, and Brad will walk us through all that here in just a few minutes. We also have a little bit later, it's Telephone Tuesday, Ethan. I'm going to try to take some phone calls in the 2 o'clock hour. You're going to pinch hit for Sue.
Yes.
Doing Sue's news. Congressman Wagner will be here. And then there's a real interesting case that I found on the Free Press this week, and it deals with a case from New York City in Brooklyn where, and I don't remember, you know, we may have talked about this case because I do address certainly some of the police shootings. In this particular case, there was a guy that was a fair, you know, jumper who got into a spat with cops in Brooklyn at a station, and he had a knife. And the cops told him, like, literally 38 times, drop the knife, drop the knife, drop the knife. He was mentally, you know, unstable. He did not drop the knife. He kind of lunged at them, and they shot him. Now, the guy was okay. What happened was, is one of the cops, this is where it gets a little different. It's a justifiable shooting, but they kind of shot across from one another. In other words, one cop shot and hit the other cop, and then there were two bystanders that were hit too. So it's not your typical police shooting. No one was killed. I think there was a serious injury. But then the issue becomes, how did the media handle that case? How did the New York Times report on that case? And it's fascinating when you look at the bias, kind of dig into that. So this guy by the name of Mike Pesca, and by the way, I don't think Mike's on our side of politics, but we'll find out. He hosts something called The Gist, which is a daily podcast, and he'll explain that story coming up in the 5 o'clock hour. We have audio cut of the day as well. Let me start with some St. Louis stuff here. And you know, you provided with some music here. Is it safe to play Sexy Red?
It, well, define safe.
Okay. This is St. Louis rapper by the name of Sexy Red. If I'm not mistaken, Sexy Red was just here not too long ago, a sold-out show down the street at Enterprise Center. You know that?
I did not know the story.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think she's kind of a big deal.
Oh, she's huge. I just didn't know that. I mean, she was just here.
She was here? Yeah. So here's the story that's in our local paper this afternoon. I got to play the music here because it's so damn good in the background. A St. Louis rapper called on her followers to attack her child's grandmother. According to claims in a lawsuit filed here this week, rapper Sexy Red, S-E-X-Y-Y, by the way, not two X's, two Y's. I think I misspelled it, Ethan, when I was sending this to you. I think you did. Yeah.
You spelled it like a normal person.
Well, I put two X's in, and I'm going to take that back. I'm going to put the two Y's
in. Okay.
She asked her fans, I can't take the music. I can't take it. No,
you should at least look at the title of the next song that I play, or I put in there. Can you read it, what it says? It's by Glorilla.
Oh, this is with Sexy Red, too?
This one is Glorilla and Sexy Red.
What you know about what?
But how's it spelled? Can you see how it's spelled?
Oh yeah.
There's no W on no. It's
K-N-O.
What you know about me?
Right. Well, that's what happens. But you know what? You mentioned Glorilla, so we have a tie-in here in a moment. I didn't know they collaborated together. It makes maybe some sense. So anyway, she asked her fans, she seems nice, on social media to kick the door of the grandmother's house and conduct acts of violence against her. Nicole Barnes, who is the paternal grandmother of one of Sexy Red's children, said on December 3rd she discovered that the rapper had shared her address and pictures of her home to Red's large following on Facebook. Her legal name, Sexy Red's legal name, is Janae Wherry, W-H-E-R-R-Y, had asked people to physically assault Barnes. Red and her... This is what I love. You don't always have an attorney with a quote like this in all cases. But here's the one from Stephen Weaver, who's the attorney for the grandmother. Sexy Red and her baby daddy. Now I'm confused because let me just tell you something right now. Hold on. I'm throwing a red flag on this whole damn segment here because I'm reading this story from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And in one line, they spell Sexy Red S-E-X-Y-Y. In the next one, they spell it S-E-X-X-Y. So which one is it?
They don't even know.
Which one is it?
Oh, my gosh.
I'm going to look it up on the music service that I have right now because I don't want to give that information. Sexy.
Okay, this says two Y's.
It's two Y's. See, they messed up at the Post-Dispatch and they threw me off. So, but here's the quote from the attorney. Sexy Red and her baby daddy are getting into beefs for whatever reason that have nothing to do with my client. We did try to informally resolve it and her attorneys thought it was a joke. And now they're finding out it's not. So she's got two kids, apparently. There is a police report on the incident when this happened in December. The grandma and her family members apparently had to move out of her Hazelwood home for their safety, and they can't find a home at a comparable price, so they're suing so they can get some money. They had to go into therapy for emotional distress. I don't know about any of that. I don't know about the therapy, but she basically doxed her own grandma, right? She said, hey, here's where she lives. Go harm her. And then, you know,
Do we know what the disagreement was over that made her do that?
No, we don't. $5 million in damages. I like this too. It says Sexy Red, who here again, they're spelling it with two Y's, who grew up in North St. Louis, is widely known for her raunchy lyrics that include graphic descriptions of sex and sexual situations. Her hits, Ethan, include Ski Ye, Pound Town, and Get It Sexy. Yeah, it says that she sold Enterprise Center out with a bunch of rappers
on
September
13th. I think that might be the part that I think is more sad, is that she sold out the Enterprise Center than anything.
I guess the story says that last year she proclaimed on social media that she'd call anyone with very curly hair carpet head if she got mad at them. She also, it says here, lambasted a vodka company after a sponsorship deal. So she has, you know, she's hot on the emotions
sure.
here. But let's get to Glorilla, who also, I guess, has worked with Sexy Red. Let's have the music here. Because this story says, I guess, Glorilla, this is another female artist, right? Are you familiar with Glorilla?
No.
I was not. Here's the headline. Fight breaks out at Glorilla concert at the Factory, shutting down the show.
B-B-G-L-O-N-A.
Now, I'm confused by this, genuinely, Ethan, because I was at the Factory with a bunch of 97.1 FM Talk listeners on Saturday night. There were about 1,600 people in the room. It was technically a sold-out show. There were a few seats that were on the ends, but technically it was a sellout.
How was the crowd? Respectable?
The crowd did not get into fights. They did not cuss at one another. They didn't throw punches. They didn't pull knives out or nothing like that. But apparently at Glorilla's concert on Monday night, there were brawls that broke out. Now, I don't know how this could happen. It seems like the same event, Brian Kilmeade and Glorilla. I don't understand, you know, I'm a little confused as to why something like this would happen, but the story says, and they quote somebody here, Ohu and Ash, 35 of St. Louis, sat in the upstairs seated area as Glorilla concluded the show. She said Glorilla's performance was nearing its end when the artist paused to ask the crowd to stop fighting. Once the scuffle was broken up, the rapper continued her set. Two more fights broke out before she called it quits.
Oh my God!
In a video recorded by Ash, Glorilla says, "We have to make sure safety is first. I love y'all, St. Louis," and then she walks off the stage. Now, they quote some people in here. Mariano Flowers, 38, said he had attended multiple Glorilla concerts before the fiasco at the Factory. This particular person drove to Chicago last year to see the rapper perform, but was very excited to catch her headlining here in St. Louis. But then said, the setup alone was recipe for disaster, okay? You know what the setup for Kilmeade show was?
Let me
you
hear.
Buy tickets. Okay. You have VIP tickets. If you show up early with the VIP tickets, you get to meet Brian. He signs a book. That the doors open at 5:30, and then the show starts. What they say here is this person paid $450 for VIP tickets to the show. That included a meet and greet with the rapper before she hits the stage. First, this person says there was a small altercation during Queen Key's set. Then two fights broke out in the rapper set. After a brief intermission, a third fight erupted. So why was it a recipe for disaster? I guess the quote here is they didn't have enough security in place to regulate the floors upstairs or downstairs, because when it came to the fights and everything, it took so long for them to even react. Well, here's the deal.
Was it a pit down low, or was it like, what is that? I've never been to the Factory.
It probably was. So, you know, here's my guess is yes. So the Factory is set up in a variety of different ways. It's a good question. For the Kilmeade show on Saturday night, the floor was all with chairs.
Okay.
And you had numbered chairs in rows. And, you know, if you're in section 103 or 104, row D, seat 5 and 6, whatever. But I've been there for, I've seen Glass Animals there, a couple other bands, and they've had no chairs on the floor. I've been there for Louis C.K. They did have, you know, chairs on the floor for that. So it depends. And then the balcony is all seating. And it really, in a venue like that, Ethan, you got to get there because it's really nice. There's no seats that are bad in the whole place. Now, there was a fair amount of security even for Kilmeade. We had wristbands on that we had to show if we were going backstage. There was someone that was positioned at the front of the stage. I saw people at the back of the stage. But if you have, and again, let me just state on the record here, I'm so confused as to culturally why there would be such a dramatic difference between the audience at Glorilla at the Factory compared to Brian Kilmeade. Maybe someone out there can help me out with that on Telephone Tuesday. But maybe it's not that the Factory didn't have enough security. Maybe they had ample security. Maybe it's because the boneheads in the audience who kept fighting were too much for them to handle. Because typically, if you go to a concert in a venue like that, Ethan, how many times you go to concerts? I've been to concerts at the Factory, at the Pageant, at Off-Broadway. The amount of times that I've seen a fight at a concert, handful. I've seen some people get into it just a little bit, pushing and shoving maybe, probably more so at a, you know, a Cardinals game or a Blues game than I have at a concert. Concerts tend to bring people together for the most part, but not at a Glorilla concert. That's what we're learning here.
That is unbelievable.
It's not.
That is crazy.
Look, I guess I can dance around the cultural issues here. It's not surprising. This is what happens, and it's not safe. And these rappers have disgusting lyrics. They hate the police, by the way, so why anyone? You know, a lot of the people, there was a Chesterfield cop that was there working, you know, for the factory. That why any cop would want to go and do anything at a rap show when these are people that hate the police, I have no idea. I wouldn't want to work that under that atmosphere at all.
So they were putting this on the factory's lack of security? Is that what they...
Yeah.
Why Look. Can't people have like take responsibility for themselves and for their crowds and say, like, the crowd was immature?
The only thing missing here is they didn't blame, you know, Whitey on this. It's probably Whitey's fault, though, because Whitey was in charge of the security. That's my guess. All right. We'll get Brad Young here in just a couple of minutes to talk about a variety of issues, including New York City's law allowing citizens to vote, which has been, you know, killed as the state's highest court has shut it down. I have a really, you know, speaking of Whitey, I have a really interesting piece here on how white American writers are getting. I'm not looking for empathy here. I'm just going to give you the facts and what's happening. And some of the numbers in this piece are staggering. We'll get to Telephone Tuesday in the next hour. We got Congresswoman Wagner at 5 o'clock and Mike Pesca. I mentioned him from the Gist podcast, plus an audio cut of the day and more. It's all coming up. Another Fish Fry Friday coming up this week at Queen of All Saints on Christopher Drive in South County. We've had a great time with these. I can't believe that we are on stop number 4 already. And Fred and Sue will be back. They're off here this week until Thursday. And then Ethan's going opening day, and he'll be back, I think, even out at the Fish Fry on Friday as well. We have Telephone Tuesday today. I'm going to take some phone calls in the next hour after Sue's news. Congressman Wagner coming up at 5:07. And then I mentioned this this story from New York, Brooklyn, actually, where a fair jumper was threatening police officers. And the way that the story was covered by the media, especially in New York City, was maybe not surprising to some of us, but pretty shocking. So we'll talk about that in the 5 o'clock hour. Plus, I will have audio cut of the day. Our legal analyst from Harris, Dow, Fisher & Young, Brad Young, back with us this afternoon. How are you, Brad?
Mark, I'm doing great, sir. Thank you.
I was looking. There's a couple of different trackers out there, and the New York Times has one where you can go and you can reference all these lawsuits that have been filed against Trump. So there's like Dellinger versus Bessent, and that's a guy named Hampton Dellinger, who is the head of a watchdog group suing for wrongful termination. You have the American Federation of Government Employees and the AFL-CIO versus the U.S. Office of Personnel Management. You have Wilcox versus Trump. You have the American Federation of Government Employees versus Trump. You have National Treasury Employees versus Vought. You have Storch versus Hegseth. I mean, and that's just like the first page. There's like 100 of these things, it seems.
Oh, there's tons of these. And listen, it's really disingenuous for anyone to say all of these lawsuits have merit or all of these lawsuits are crap. I mean, both of those positions are wrong. Just like any group of litigation, Mark, some have merit, some do not. And you have to go through and look at each individual case on the facts and the law of that case. And no one can just lump them all into one category or the other.
But how can you, you know, I look down this list, and again, I'm just scratching the surface. Some of this, you know, it's the National Association of Diversity Officers in Higher Education versus Trump. Hey, I think I'm pretty comfortable solving that one right here and now. Association of American Medical Colleges versus the National Institutes of Health. You have the mayor and city council of Baltimore versus Vought. I mean, the list goes on and on. This could drag on for a long time, which I think is part of the goal on the other side.
Oh, sure it is, because you remember during the first Trump administration, the first 2 years of that entire administration was just spent fighting this myth of Russian collusion and the Russians buying the election for Donald Trump with a $100,000 Facebook ad buy. All right. And so that really stymied and derailed the Trump administration the first time around dealing with that. So this time, it's the same playbook, but Trump is not allowing himself to be distracted by all this lawfare. He's getting things done, some of which I agree with legally, some I don't. But listen, he's pushing forward, and he's not getting distracted.
So when it comes to adjudication on any of those issues, would there be any expectation that some of this stuff will even be settled in the next 2 years?
Oh, I think a lot of it's going to be, frankly, dismissed.
Okay.
I mean, in fact, one of the lawsuits, the New Hampshire Indonesian Community Support versus Donald J. Trump, it's an organization with non-citizen members whose unborn children stand to have their citizenship under question. Okay, that's not going anywhere. You can't file a lawsuit on behalf of unborn children who may or may not be citizens. That's going to be dismissed. A lot of these are going to be dismissed, but those that have merit are going to move forward. On the merits, and there will be decisions here in some of these cases that Donald Trump supporters will not agree with, and others that they will, and that's why it's always difficult to look at legal analysis through the prism of politics, because you have to analyze it on the merits of the case.
So let's go back a couple of years, because I know you and I talked about this at the time. New York passes this law to allow non-citizens to vote in city elections. And to most of us who are sane, that's crazy. That is insanity, right? But apparently the people in New York think it's a good idea. But of course, that's challenged in the courts. And lo and behold, the New York Court of Appeals has ruled that that law is a violation of the state constitution, which I think a lot of us thought to begin with. But it was a 6-1 ruling. Who's the bonehead that ruled against it?
Well, one of the progressives. But listen, the majority of the New York Supreme Court, in fact, it's not technically called the Supreme Court. In New York, they're so messed up, they call their district courts the Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah, I
but
knew
in
that.
This instance, right. Yeah, but in this instance, the High Court in New York, most of the progressives on there voted to strike this down. And it's very simple. It's very simple. Under the New York Constitution, it specifically states that every, quote, every citizen shall be entitled to vote in every election, unquote. So if you're not a citizen under the state constitution, you can't vote. It's not that hard. And yet this shows you what the progressive left wants to do, because this would have allowed 800,000 people to vote in municipal contests such as mayoral races when they're not even citizens of this country. I mean, go to France and try to vote in a French election if you're not a citizen. Go to Canada.
I know.
They don't allow that nonsense.
Why
would
they?
And those places are progressive.
It's insane. Look, even Eric Adams. Look, Eric Adams was a little tricky on this, as you know. He didn't sign the bill, but he didn't veto it. So that meant that it went into law in 2022. And at the time, I don't know if he's flipped around on this a little bit, Brad, or not, but he did express support. And he said New Yorkers should have a say in their government. Well, how about New Yorkers who are legally in this country should have a say in their government? We can all get on that same page.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was disappointed in him. But I think right now, Eric Adams has learned that the progressive left is not his friend, and they're not there to help him. And I think a 2025 version of Eric Adams would have vetoed that law. But listen, we can't go back in time. If we could, you know, I'd do something about my hairline.
And I do something about the Mizzou basketball finish to the season. There's no doubt about that. All right, let's talk about a couple other issues, including the bankruptcy of 23andMe. And this is a little unique because I'm a 23andMe person. I sent my DNA in many years ago just to kind of see if there were any matches or stuff like that. So the question now becomes, will private data that was shared by, you know, us and a lot of people around the world with 23andMe perhaps be in jeopardy?
Yes. Not perhaps, it will be.
Great.
And there's no question. I mean, that's why for years, I've been a vocal opponent of 23andMe. And let me give you a great example. There have been multiple murders solved, and someone say, what's the problem with this? But we even look at the most recent example with the guy in the Idaho college murders. He was found because they obtained DNA.
Right.
The government agencies utilized commercial services. They never disclosed which one, but it was either 23andMe or one just like it, to find relatives that fit that DNA profile match. Then they go to the house, they collect their own DNA, and boom, it matches. So literally, anytime you give up your DNA, and let me kind of explain the background and then the legality of the bankruptcy. Anytime you give up your DNA to these agencies or companies, then basically you are ratting out your relatives. Even if it's not your direct relatives, you're ratting out your genetic relatives when it comes to any potential criminal activity. Now, let's look at the legal side. When you, Mark, signed up for 23andMe, they promised to keep your data safe and secure and not to transfer it to any third party. However, in the terms of service that you signed, probably didn't read it.
Of course.
But in the terms of service you signed, it gave a loophole to 23andMe. And it said, if at any time 23andMe goes out of business, they retain the right to sell your private data to any third party in the course of bankruptcy. Well, guess what? Yeah, they're in bankruptcy right now.
And by the way, they filed it here in Missouri, right?
What's that?
They filed it here in Missouri.
Yeah, and I'm not sure of what the benefit is to doing that. Most of the time, you see those types of corporate bankruptcies being filed in Delaware. So I haven't researched why they filed it in Missouri. But the bottom line is that anyone, including Mark Reardon, who gave their information, their most private, secure, personal data, your DNA, to these companies like 23andMe, it's now going to go into the wind whenever they sell it to a third party.
Okay, I might not be a big fan of that, but let's go back to the whole ratting out your relatives thing. I don't know that I have as big of an issue with that as you do, because I'm trying to think through the process here. But, you know, when I think the reason that a lot of people go out there with 23andMe, well, there's a couple of reasons. They can break down the DNA from a health perspective, which, by the way, I chickened out on. I didn't want to know if I'm going to die, you know, at the age of 70. I just kind of let that out there and someone else can figure that out. But on the topic of just seeing if there's a match out there for someone in the past, you kind of assume that some of this stuff might be shared in that particular manner. So I don't really have an issue. Why should I have an issue if they go out there and say, okay, now we think that, you know, Mark's son is a murderer, so we have to see if there's a DNA match, just for privacy reasons.
No, two reasons why that should be troubling to you. Number one, you haven't given consent.
Okay.
All right. If someone comes to me and says, Brad, we think your sister committed a crime, I get to make the decision. Do I want to testify against her or not? I get to make that decision. In this instance, that decision's already been made for you because you gave up your DNA.
Right.
Secondly, if we look at the college murders case, let's change the facts a little bit. All right. You've only seen it used in cases where it actually solidified a conviction of a heinous crime. But what if we change the facts a little bit, and it turns out that this guy in Utah really didn't commit this crime, but he was being framed because of the DNA that you gave up to 23andMe. At that point, you couldn't go and say, whoa, don't try to frame my relative with fake information or incorrect information, because, again, that has been taken out of your hands, so to speak, and you don't have any say in how it's used.
I understand the privacy issues. I'll have to think through that one just a little more, because that is a tricky issue. By the way, on the topic of, you know, a lot of this, not necessarily DNA, I mentioned this yesterday and I finished the documentary. Are you familiar at all? Have you gone down this Karen Reed trial rabbit hole from Boston?
I have not. I mean, I'm vaguely familiar with it just from reading the news, but I've not dove into it very deeply.
Just to kind of summarize it, there was a Boston cop who was found dead in the snow on the early morning. I think it was January 29th, a few years ago. It was during the winter. There was a blizzard. They were all out partying, a big group of people. And then they said, hey, let's go to this friend's house. And that's where something bad happened. The question that's addressed in the film and the documentary is, did this woman, Karen Reed, who was the boyfriend of Michael O'Keefe, the cop, did she run him over with her car? Did she murder him? Was it an accident? Does she even remember what happened, because there was a lot of alcohol involved? But then the question is, the defense puts this in a different, you know, perspective. Hey, these people inside the house, they did some funny business too. What was going on? There were a bunch of butt dials at 2 a.m, all this stuff back and forth. And it leads you down this path of not really knowing, you know, what the truth is in this particular case. And this has torn apart this community out there in Boston. It's been, you know, a big media event. But I will say this, Brad, it's a good documentary from the standpoint that it's entertaining, but I always go back to Making a Murderer, which is about Stephen Avery in Wisconsin, and I was very familiar with that case, and I have friends that covered that from the start to the finish, and that particular documentary did lead the audience down a path where you thought maybe Stephen Avery was not guilty. I can guarantee you one thing, he's guilty as hell. So in this particular case, you're not sitting through the whole trial, so do you have all the facts? It's good TV.
Exactly.
It's good TV, but is it good you know, is it accurate? That I don't know at this point, but it's
yeah.
It's worth
well,
a watch.
I can tell you it isn't because for two reasons. Number one is when a case goes to trial, there are enormous limitations on what the jury gets to see and what they don't get to see. Now, that's obviously out the window in a documentary. Secondly, the documentary is done to convince the watcher, the listener of the documentary, of a specific point of view. In a trial, you get both sides, and so you're missing that in a documentary.
I would say in the Stephen Avery documentary, absolutely. In this one, I will say this. I think they did a pretty good job. They feature members of this guy's family. It's relatively well-balanced. Look, it's about this woman, so is it tipped in her direction because she's the star, Karen Reed? And by the way, they have all these people that follow her around. They're fans of hers. The whole thing is creepy. But I thought in the end, the documentarians did a pretty good job of you know, casting questions, aspersion to some of the theories from the defense. So it's compelling. It's worth a look for sure.
I know, but look at the Menendez brothers situation. I mean, the only reason they were getting this so-called second shot at freedom is because of the Netflix documentary,
right,
which was clearly one-sided. It didn't demonstrate the evidence like you would in a court of trial, in a court of law. And really, it completely overshadowed the idea that even though they claimed their defense was based upon molestation by the father, they still killed the mother.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no allegation that the mother killed him, that the mother molested them, rather, and yet they still killed the mother. So I just have a problem with all of these true crime types of documentaries, and I think we should just leave it up to Only Murders in the Building.
Just Sue would support you on that. By the way, just to be clear on the Netflix thing, that was an episodic drama about the Menendez. However, there were other documentaries that were, you know, along those same lines for sure. All right, Brad Young, I appreciate it. You got to swing by one of our fish fries here coming up.
Yeah, I will. I'll connect with Hall of Famer Fred Bottenheimer and see when I can swing by.
Yeah, he is back in town in a couple of days. And
how about old Fred Bottenheimer over there, ladies and gentlemen?
There you go. There's Kenny Wallace. Thank you, Brad. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right, we'll see you soon. 3:42. We'll take a break. We're coming back. I got a real interesting little piece and some stats that might shock you about white authors and their success out there in the book business. A little shocking, maybe not. We'll get to it coming up.
Traffic from the 97.1 FM Talk Traffic Center.
All right, we've got 170 big time delays southbound, pretty heavy from Page down to Forest Park Parkway. Roughly, there's a crash in a lane there. Northbound side's hanging in there okay. 270, your northbound side from Manchester to 64, a little slow. Southbound from Page down to 64. If you have 44 on your westbound side, heavy from about 70 to 77th Street. And then we've got 55 southbound delays. Broadway down to Bates, gotten kind of heavy through that work zone. 64 eastbound side, slow from Mason to 270, but westbound slow spots from Kings Highway to past Lindbergh. Then you're really jammed from Highway K, just past Highway K to past Lake St. Louis Boulevard. We still have that police activity hanging out in the right lane there. I'm Trent Erickson with traffic on 97.1 FM Talk.
O'Reilly Veriscan is a free check engine light testing program that pulls from over 600 million vehicle scans confirmed by ASE certified technicians to provide a simple report and possible fixes. Available exclusively at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I want to talk about Susan L. Ward. She is a family practice attorney here in St. Louis. And, you know, they even have a section on the website at slfamilylaw.com where they kind of go through some tips on how you should choose your attorney and what factors are the most important part in choosing a lawyer. Well, you have to have confidence in their experience, their responsiveness, their compatibility, the style, negotiating skills, reputation, and, of course, fees play into this as well. And I think you're going to find when it comes to Susan and assessing her in all the those areas, you'll be very comfortable. The website has really a lot of information, even some suggestions on how you should, you know, choose your lawyer, how you should be represented by a lawyer. They have a great, you know, if you will, tutorial up there about some of the things that they do. And in the practice areas, you'll find that they handle everything from divorce, anything related to kids, domestic partnerships, post-divorce issues that could mean modifications to existing orders, child support, and they also handle domestic violence cases as well. You can always reach Susan and the team at 314-783-9400. And I mentioned that website, which has everything that you can need, even a confidential consultation form, stlfamilylaw.com, stlfamilylaw.com. The focus on family law, the emphasis on you, Susan L. Ward. What I'm so sad about Budweiser. pulling out of Pride. What will they do in downtown St. Louis? So let's talk about wokeness that occurs in publishing. And let's just, you know, state a few things here from the get-go. As a white person, a lot of us like to joke. And look, we just see what's happening out there in the advertising world in particular, where you're hard-pressed to find a commercial out there for a major product that doesn't have representation of nearly every race. And hopefully not too much representation of white people. I mean, they go over and above with biracial relationships and shows. It's all about DEI, even in Hollywood. So it is what it is. I'm not complaining about that. You know, do you want empathy as a white guy? In fact, in the piece that I'm about to describe, there was one dude who was an author that's very uncomfortable with even talking about this because he goes, what's the point in even being upset about such supposed indignities as not being published as a white guy? Well, I think there is something to it. And that's why I'm going to share the numbers here this afternoon, because this is not an accident. Compact Magazine is an organization out there that put an article together looking at the numbers where there's a clear trend away from publishing and giving awards to white male offers. Now, again, some people are going to roll their eyes at this, even if they would see, you know, the headline. But I actually read it. And when I read it, I wanted to share it even more because the numbers are really staggering. So what they said in that particular outlet, Compact Magazine, it's easy enough to trace the decline of young white men in American letters. Just browse the New York Times notable fiction list. In 2012, the New York Times included 7 white American men under the age of 43. That's the cutoff for a millennial today. In 2013, there were 6. In 2014, there were 6. And then by 2021, there was not one white male millennial on the notable fiction list. There were none again in 2022. There was one in 2023 and 2024. They indicate since 2021, just 2 of 72 millennials featured were white American men. Now, let me give you a little hint and secret on something, too. These numbers are accurate. They're real. And all you have to do is Google Super Bowl halftime show. And just look at the Super Bowl halftime show from, let's say, George Floyd on. Right? I'll just leave it at that. There were no white male millennials featured in Vulture's 2024 year-end fiction list, none in Vanity Fair's, none in the Atlantic's Esquire, a magazine that is geared toward male millennials, actually. They featured 53 millennial fiction writers on its year-end book list since 2020. Only one was a white American man. That's kind of crazy. Esquire, 53 millennial fiction writers on the year-end book list in the last 5 years. Only one of them? I guess white dudes aren't writing any fiction at this point, right? Over the course of the 2010s, the literary pipeline for white men was effectively shut down. Between 2001 and 2011, 6 white men won the New York Public Library's Young Lions Prize for debut fiction. Since 2020, not a single white man has even been nominated of 25 total nominations. The past decade has seen 70 finalists for the Center for Fiction's first novel prize, with, again, not a single straight white American millennial man. Of 14, I just think it's interesting. I don't really, because I know some people say, quit bitching, you're a white dude, right? I think these numbers are interesting because they're so lopsided. The past decade has seen 70 finalists for the Center for Fiction's first novel prize, with, again, not a single straight white American male, I think I repeated that one, of 14 finalists for the National Book Award during the same time period, exactly 0 are white men. The Wallace Stegner Fellowship at Stanford, a launching pad for young writers, currently has 0 white male fiction and poetry fellows. Of 25 fiction fellows since the year 2020, just 1 was a white man. Now, maybe there's something more going on here, right? But I think what you're going to find here, and the reason that I brought this up, is there's a clear trend here. And you're going to find, I think it was even The Hollywood Reporter. I can't remember who dared to do a story about this. It might have been The Hollywood Reporter. But white dudes in Hollywood aren't getting gigs anymore either. If you're writing a show, it used to be all white dudes, so now you have to overcompensate because too many white dudes. Remember when Frasier was out and Cheers and Friends? Too many damn white people producing the show, writing the show, acting in the show. We got to do something about it. We can't have white people dating white people in relationships on television. It's not the way it happens in real Well, yeah, it is. Okay. But we can't represent real life. We have to show every relationship, every commercial has to be biracial. We must overrepresent certainly people on the other side. And we do that in the name of anti-racism to make sure that we are washed away from all of our sins from the past 300 years or so, right? 200 years, 250, or whatever the number. I'm not good at math. But that's essentially what's happening in that situation. That is really, those numbers are quite something. And I don't expect that they would trend in another direction. We'll take a break here for the top of the hour. When we return, Ethan will be here pinch hitting for Sue. She's got Sue's news. Also, it's a telephone Tuesday this afternoon, so I got some phone call topics to get to in the 4 o'clock hour. Congresswoman Ann Wagner will be here. They had spring break last week in Congress as well. They're back at it in Washington. She is on the Intel Committee, and I think there's a pretty important hearing for her tomorrow. Also, you know, we had Mike and Gonzalez on from Heritage yesterday. Mike was fantastic, and we kind of broke the news that Mike will be on the hearing panel tomorrow for Marjorie Taylor Greene's DOGE committee, and he's going to specifically be talking about defunding NPR and PBS. And I'm going to ask Ann Wagner that question as well. Do you support that? And I think she's going to. We'll talk about it when she joins us at 5:07.